Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am just fine.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, Joss Whedon got a big profile in the New York Magazine. Link just dropped a couple hours before this tape. We were going to do a whole segment. We scrapped it so we could talk about this breaking news that Joss Whedon is still kind of a dick. Here are the headlines. Here are the headlines from this big profile, okay? He denies being abusive towards Charisma Carpenter. Charisma Carpenter, of course, had said that she got pregnant and then he fired her from the show Angel because she got fat. He denies having sex with people from the cast and crew on set, but he does not deny having affairs with them. So, you know, we're kind of splitting some hairs here. He denies threatening Gal Gadot, Wonder Woman, who he directed in the Justice League reshoots, implying in his denial that she's too dumb to understand what he actually said. And also, he denies changing the skin tone of black characters in Justice League, saying that Ray Fisher is a shitty actor. That's literally what he said.
He did not say the word shitty actor.
He said he was a bad actor in both senses of the term. I didn't say it in quotes, did I? I'm paraphrasing here. When I want to quote Joss Whedon, I'll quote Joss Whedon. But I don't think that this is an unfair characterization of what he said. He said that Ray Fisher's a bad actor, and that's why I cut him out of the movie. And he said that Zack Snyder, and maybe his minions more than Zack Snyder, used the issue to unfairly attack Whedon as a racist. And he admits to having sex addiction, like Kevin Spacey and Harvey Weinstein before him. I found the whole thing pretty fascinating because there's a lot of cluelessness on Joss Whedon's part, I would say, and there is I think he thinks he's been treated unfairly. I think he thinks he's been treated unfairly. Alyssa, do you think that's fair to say?
I think it is fair to say that Whedon thinks he has been treated unfairly. But this profile is amazing, both for the way Whedon conducts himself in it, and also just as a sort of artifact of the contemporary culture of culture, right? I mean, the most telling thing about the entire profile is both he and his ex-wife apparently have the same diagnosis of complex post-traumatic stress disorder, which, you know, is not to belittle anyone who has complex PTSD. It's a real syndrome. You know, it has a serious impact on people's lives. But the extent to which sort of therapeutic culture has taken over pop culture in general, and the fact that, it is a diagnosis that has become sort of an identity that can be used to explain everything, and it's kind of amazingly apt that it comes up in the profile this way of like both halves of a former couple. One claiming that his terrible behavior towards his ex-wife and other people is driven by this diagnosis, and the other person saying that, you know, her ex-husband's terrible behavior caused this diagnosis in her, right? It's like it is almost too meta to be believed. And the thing that it put me in mind of was actually Parul Segal wrote this really interesting argument for The New Yorker earlier this month. It's the case against the trauma plot. And it's about how, you know, all stories now are sort of looking backwards for explanations as opposed to being driven forward by a plot. Or to the extent that they're driven forward by plot, it is in service of the return to the past to try and figure out where characters' motivations come from and what their actions are driven by. And this profile is both such a textbook example of that storytelling mode and an illustration of the flimsiness of it. It's just amazing. I mean, you know, Whedon essentially claims to have been excavating his past, particularly his childhood. And yet the profile is sort of devoid of detail about sort of what this childhood consisted of, right? I mean, it's apparently his brothers bullied him and his parents were kind of combative drunks. And, you know, there was a childhood tragedy involving, like, a drowning of a school friend.
One of his childhood friends died in a pond, and he just, like, kind of tosses this off in the profile as, maybe this?
Yeah.
Is why I'm like this.
But
it's all kind of like the cave scene in Avengers 2.
Right. But even if this stuff is an explanation for, you know, cheating on your wife a lot and being a kind of rotten person consistently in a professional context over literally decades, like what is it? Tell us, what is it useful to know this and to know about this, right? I mean, the much more interesting thing happening in the profile is the extent to which Whedon was an avatar of a certain kind of fandom, especially in sort of the early late 90s, early aughts, where, you know, sort of the creator became synonymous with the work and became in some ways even more important than the work itself. Like, being a fan of Joss Whedon was an identity. It was a cultural phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And it was obviously not one that was sustainable. And so the way that fans are reckoning with this development is much more interesting than any explanation Whedon could possibly put forth for his behavior, right? I mean, at the end of the day, he still seems like kind of a jackass. You know, the attempt to explain that just is, it's not even that it's not exculpatory. It's not interesting.
Yeah. Alyssa, let me ask, and Peter, I'll come to you in one sec. But Alyssa, I want to ask you as a feminist reader of pop culture, and as somebody who I believe you were into Buffy, mm-hmm. right? You were How much of this fall from grace has to do with specifically with people feeling betrayed by him, like they thought they knew him. And they thought that this was, you know, one of their people. And it turns out that a lot of his posturing is a cover for his own bad behavior.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think one thing the profile gets at really well is the extent to which Whedon made himself accessible to fans, that he, you know, participated in message boards and had, you know, even went to some sort of fan get togethers and stuff. He was, you know, he made himself a consumable object. And it seems pretty clear that, you know, Whedon kind of embraced, you know, the feminist readings of his work and positioned himself as a feminist in part because, you know, it made him popular. It got him laid. It was, you know, I think that some of, you know, his interest in women's stories is, you know, genuine and interesting. And I think Buffy is great television, whether or not you think Joss Whedon is a good person. In some ways, it is even better television for its sort of complexity and darkness. I mean, there's a subplot where Buffy begins a relationship with a vampire who tried to rape her at one point. And this was something that, you know, some very straightforward feminist readings of Buffy, you know, sort of painted as, you know, read not unnaturally as sort of troubling or problematic, but that was sort of what was interesting about the story, that Buffy at that point was, you know, working through some of her, you know, trauma from vampire slaying by engaging in a relationship that was not super healthy for her, that, you know, involved risk and kind of giving up some power. And so to the extent that, you know, the feminism of Whedon's work is complex, that his, you know, his heroines are not always making choices that are, you know, heroic or fit neatly to a simple story of empowerment, that makes that work more interesting. And Whedon himself, you know, clearly is a more complicated person than the one he benefited from being perceived as being for a very long time.
Peter, as both an editor and a consumer of pop culture, what did you make of this piece? Because it is a big sprawling piece, considering that it is kind of only focused on one person and his rise and fall. I was curious about some of the choices. I mean, one criticism that I've seen pop up again just in the last hour or so is that the author seems more seems to agree with Joss Whedon on certain things. That's not how I read it. That is not how I read that piece at all. It seems pretty damning to me from start to finish.
So I think what's interesting about the piece is that it doesn't provide you with a tidy conclusion. And that's going to frustrate some people. And I think, you know, from an editorial perspective, you could maybe make an argument that it's a little too sprawly, that it sometimes does that. On the one hand, it seems to want to sort of capture the whole online argument about Joss Whedon, like from, you know, the late 1990s until now in a single piece. And on the other hand, there are places, as Alyssa said, in particular with like Joss Whedon's backstory and his childhood, where it seems to sort of suggest something without actually following the rabbit hole, you know, like following that, that thread enough, right? And you could perhaps, you could make an argument maybe that this piece should have followed a single thread or a smaller number of threads a little bit more. But I actually think it's just, this is a really interesting piece of journalism because it doesn't demand that you come away with one clear conclusion about Joss Whedon. And the thing that jumped out at to me most was the way it treated internet culture. And Sonny, I want to actually ask you about this because a big part of it comes in the Justice League passage when it talks about the rivalry between Joss Whedon fans and between Zack Snyder fans online. And there's this thing that the author does throughout the profile where fandom is just sort of referred to as like a as an online hive mind, right? And it's like Joss Whedon fans have been saying these things, and there's no place where they are saying them, right? Like you sort of assume it's on Twitter or on message boards or on Facebook or something, right? They're not quoted, and there's no sort of like source for where these arguments are happening, and it works somehow or another because we now all just assume that like fandom that there are these like almost like AI hive swarm brain fandom creatures that just like live online and have these. And have these group collective personalities. And in some ways, a lot of that, not all of it, but a lot of that is an outgrowth of the culture, of the fan culture that sprung up in large part around Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And so just it's just a really interesting choice to treat Whedon fans as a character who don't need to be. Like, it's not that there's no quotations of individual. There are a couple of little individual, you know, quotes here, but mostly it's that Whedon fans are their own character. That's a really interesting choice. And then, I mean, and then you know what Alyssa said, I thought was just spot on. This piece, I don't know whether it is actually engaging in it itself or whether it is showing us that Joss Whedon is doing this. But this piece does an awful lot of sort of it shows us a world in which all problems and all bad behavior are medicalized because when you medicalize them, when you say this is a therapeutic, this is something that's wrong with me, I have an ailment, then it excuses your bad behavior, right? Like this Whedon's special form of PTSD, whatever it is that he was diagnosed with, he is deploying that. And I'm not saying he doesn't have it, and I'm not saying it's not a real diagnosis or that it doesn't actually affect people here. But there is there is something that he is doing here where he is talking about this as like a as something that like he has no control over, and therefore he can't really be, in some sense, can't be blamed for what he did, right? And so it is a form of excuse making, I think, at least on Whedon's part. I don't know if the piece is actually supportive of that theory or not. Again, I think it's a somewhat complex piece.
Peter, I just want to push back very, very briefly against the idea that the piece doesn't have a tidy conclusion. This is the closing of the profile. People had been using, quote, every weaponizable word of the modern era to make it seem like I was an abusive monster, end quote, Whedon said. Quote, I think I'm one of the nicer showrunners that's ever been, end quote. And here's how I read this, both as a writer and an editor and just a reader, is he has been given the rope to hang himself. The whole point of this rehabilitation tour is for people to say, oh, Joss Whedon has learned his lesson. He understands what he's done wrong. You know, he's going to be different and changed and better. And I read that and I think he doesn't have any clue. He doesn't have any clue why he's in trouble in the first place. He doesn't have any clue how to fix himself. I read that as like, don't trust this guy and don't give him another chance.
Yeah, I mean, this is a piece where the writer not only hands him the rope but like hands him the wood and the nails to build the gibbet, right? I mean, early on in the piece, you know, Whedon tells her that he has been advised, like say he has to go to the bathroom whenever he doesn't want to answer a question and needs time to compose himself. And then the writer has him do that multiple times throughout the profile, right? I mean, she sort of shows us the artifice here and the kind of the self-pity and sort of self-exculpatory nature of everything Whedon is doing. It just, it's, I mean, everything he says about sort of his own recovery, his second marriage, I mean, it just all comes across as so flimsy. So the idea that it sides with Whedon in any way is, you know, is difficult for me to understand as a reading. It seems pretty clear to me.
I don't think it sides with Whedon, but what it doesn't do is like is stage a confrontation where Whedon gets shown the error of his ways. What it doesn't do is like wrap up in a like a here's the truth about Joss Whedon. What it does is, like you said, Sonny, is it lets Whedon tell the story as he wants to tell the story, and at least a lot of it is fairly damning to Whedon and shows that Whedon has not reckoned with his behavior and is finding ways to avoid doing so.
Yeah. To your broader point about fandoms and the way it's treated and the way fandom in general is treated in the piece, and specifically the Whedon fandoms versus Snyder fandoms are treated. I think you're both right that this is the most interesting idea in the piece, and that I also think that the author doesn't have any idea what to do with it and like really kind of fumbles with it. And part of the problem is that there is a notion in this, not just that they are monolithic, but they are that these fandoms are so rooted in ideology and whatever else that it strips them of all agency. So there's a very weird passage in this where the author is talking about how, you know, at one point Zack Snyder was super problematic because he made 300, and that was a movie that people said was anti-Persian. But now Joss Whedon is the problematic one because he's a harasser. And how are the people who are deciding what to watch based on what's problematic supposed to know what to do? And it's just like, maybe that's actually a really dumb and bad way to filter your art. Like, maybe that's actually a really dumb way to try and decide what is good and what is bad and what is worth watching and what is worth supporting is filtering all of these things through your ideological proclivities and trying to decide who is the good guy and who's the bad guy based on like who you think they might have voted for at some point in the past.
But it's also,
I mean, you do need to disclose your role as the king of the Snyder super fans.
I am but a cog in the release the Snyder cut clockwork. I am not the mastermind here at all.
But what's interesting, I mean, whether or not that's a stupid way to view your art, it's very interesting that it has become such powerful currency, and currency that, you know, like HBO and Warner Brothers was going to listen to, that, you know, finding a way to re-narrativize Snyder became sort of a powerful tool for the fandom. And look, I'm someone who has long argued that Snyder is more interested in women than he's often given credit for. The fact that, you know, Deborah Snyder produces his projects, that he has this sort of productive working relationship with his wife, that has, you know, sort of really elevated women's stories in some interesting ways. Like, I've made that argument before. It was cool. But yeah, I mean,
Sucker Punch Hive.
Yes, indeed. man, I wrote my defense of Sucker Punch back on Blogger. That was a long time ago. And so, you know, I think that the rise of that kind of thinking as currency is something that Whedon made possible and that he's now sort of run afoul of. And so I think that's the more interesting part of that section of the piece.
So what did you guys make of the somewhat extended interview with the writer Rebecca X, who at one point was known as Rebecca Rand Kirshner, who wrote for several seasons of Buffy, and seems to have like a really conflicted relationship with her own feelings about Joss Whedon in a way that I thought was really interesting, in that it suggested that it at least raised the possibility that what Joss Whedon was doing on set was not okay, but also not exactly wildly uncommon on sets in Hollywood, right? I mean, you know, and also, you know, maybe maybe not quite as bad as some of the Joss Whedon is a monster people have made out, right? There's this quote here where she talks about Whedon calling her fat, but say when she was pregnant, right? So a story we've heard before, but she says it was kind of a joke. Now she says also that was a joke that hurt, and I don't think it was okay, but I did understand that it wasn't necessarily meant as just like a cruelly sneering thing. It was a little bit of an inappropriate joke. And then she says, and she ends this quote with, "My point is, it was a dick move, but I wouldn't call it abuse."
Yeah.
And making that distinction here, it is kind of interesting and allows for some gray space in the, like, what do we think of Joss Whedon's bad behavior, you know, question.
That whole section reminded me of the bit in The Dark Knight where Batman talks about how the Joker attracts unstable minds. I mean, that's literally the thing that came to mind, was like, Joss Whedon is the sort of person who, and the woman says this later in the piece, like, I find myself attracted to abusive relationships. Like, I am particularly susceptible to being in abusive relationships. And I don't know that that's the best defense of him, but it is the best. It's the best defense of him in this piece, is like, he was kind of a dick. Being kind of a dick isn't necessarily the same as being, a perpetrator of Me Too style capital offenses.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's probably too long as a section of the piece, just, you know, from a sort of editorial perspective. But it gets at these sort of the mixed feelings that people have about Whedon, and I think, and about the fact that drawing that line between clearly abusive behavior and someone just being relentlessly unpleasant can be difficult.
Yeah. So what do we think? Is this profile of Joss Whedon a controversy or a non-controversy, Peter?
Well, Joss Whedon is a controversy of a sort, right? Like, that's why this profile exists. Is the profile itself?
I don't know.
I think the answer is no. I think the profile itself is a controversy, but Joss Whedon's behavior and career is a controversy, and so, yeah.
Alyssa, what do you think here? Let me clarify. Do you think that Joss Whedon's continued existence on planet Earth as a human being is a controversy or a non-troversy?
I think it's non-troversial, but only because hellmouths don't actually exist, and therefore we can't throw him into one.
I think it's a controversy that he has no idea why people hate him, and he has no idea how to get himself out of this hole. He strikes me as, like, weirdly unself-aware for somebody who is as self-aware as he kind of portrays himself to be. So, boo Joss Whedon. If you enjoy this show, and who doesn't except for Joss Whedon, it's great. Please head over to atma.thebulwark.com, where Peter and I will discuss the greatness of Scream and make the case to Alyssa that even fraidy cats like her should go see it. And now on to the main event. Macbeth, The Tragedy of Macbeth. It's director Joel Coen's first solo effort. He did not make this with his brother Ethan, which is somewhat controversial. It is, of course, the retelling of Shakespeare's classic tragedy of the Scottish noble turned king turned madman turned tragic dire. I guess tragic victim
tragic
of death. So here's the thing about filmed Shakespeare, is that it has this weird dual problem where if you try and film it as a play, you run into all the problems of a film play. And if you try and film it as a movie, you run into all the problems of Shakespeare in the modern world, which is that it doesn't quite make sense. I mean, the only film I think that has really squared that circle nicely is Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet. But that was so artificial and so full of artifice that it was different. What Joel Coen does here, I think, is very interesting. He basically avoids this trap by making it look like a film play by shooting every scene as if it was built for the stage, but then filming that like it's a movie. I mean, it looks like a movie that takes place on about 1,000 different stages, which is interesting and different, not quite how it has been done before. It calls to mind the German expressionist films of the 1920s and 30s. Lots of sharp angles, lots of shadows, lots of real stylization here.
It's very The Seventh Seal meets Ansel Adams.
Yeah, or like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, or, you know, stuff like that, right? Denzel Washington plays Macbeth here. And I am not the Macbeth expert. I'm going to kick this to Alyssa to kick us off here in a second. But I am not the Macbeth expert. But I feel like this is a slightly older Macbeth than one usually sees. And I like that treatment of the character as opposed to some of the younger Macbeths, because it makes him, and it works specifically with the Coen brothers style, because it makes him feel kind of more pathetic than a younger Macbeth. This is the last gasp of somebody who has spent his whole life being passed over time and again, despite being, you know, competent and thinking he deserves more. He feels a little bit henpecked by Lady Macbeth in a way that I don't know that I've seen before. And I love what Denzel does with this just in terms of line readings. There's this just wonderful moment kind of late in the film as he has entered full Mad King phase, where he tells a character to take thy face hence. And it just has made me laugh both times that I've seen it. Also great, Catherine Hunter as the three weird sisters, the witches. She is a veteran stage actor, but also kind of a contortionist. She's doing weird, interesting things with her body that seem almost supernatural. And Stephen Root as the wacky porter, you know, making sex jokes. Love a good sex joke in a Shakespeare movie or play. And he is perfect here. I'll be honest. I watched this twice. I watched this once during award season, and I was kind of like, okay, this is fine. It's Shakespeare. I like Shakespeare. Macbeth. It's Macbeth. Macbeth is one of the best Shakespeare plays. Everybody loves Macbeth. But it didn't do a ton for me. I watched it again a second time with subtitles on in glorious 4K on my TV, as opposed to a crappy, you know, 1080p stream, like an idiot. I realize now that I basically have to read Shakespeare. I just have no ear for it. It's a lot like musicals for me. I need the subtitles, because otherwise I just get kind of lost and confused. But I am a schmuck, and we all know that. Alyssa, you are the Shakespeare expert on the show, I think. How does this compare to other adaptations of Macbeth that you have seen?
So I think the most interesting thing about it as an adaptation, aside from Washington's performance, which I think is tremendous, is actually what it does with a secondary character, the Thane of Ross, who is played by Alex Hassel, who's I think primarily a British stage actor. And I want to back up a minute, because one of the mysteries of Macbeth is sort of known in the collective scholarship of it as the mystery of the third murderer, because when Macbeth sends two men to kill Banquo, he only assigns two of them the job, but in the play a third murderer shows up. He has like six lines. He's basically a non-character, and there has been a scholarly debate about who the third murderer is supposed to be, because he just sort of materializes in that scene and he's not seen anywhere else. There are some people who think it's supposed to be Macbeth himself, who is showing up to make sure the job gets done. And in this version, the third murderer is Ross. And, you know, Ross is another one of, you know, Duncan's thanes. He's a lord. But the movie makes a couple of other changes too, right? He shows up at the murder of Macduff's wife and son, and then is the person who comes and informs Macduff that his wife and child are dead. He, unlike in the original play, you know, Macduff is the person who kills Macbeth, as happens here in the adaptation, but then it's Macduff who presents Macbeth's head and his crown to Malcolm, the son of Duncan. Here it's Ross who does it again. And then finally, like the last scene in the adaptation, we see that he has spared Banquo's son Fleance and is fleeing with him on horseback. He's sort of done it secretly. And so Ross emerges as this sort of secondary manipulator in the play, perhaps a more sophisticated player of the game than Macbeth himself. He has managed to appear loyal to Macbeth until the very end of the play, even to the extent of carrying out one of his uglier schemes, the murder of Macduff's wife and his son. But he manages to maintain Macduff and Malcolm's favor, even as at the end he is riding off with the child who presumably, you know, it is the fulfillment of the prophecy that Banquo will give rise to a line of kings. And, you know, that was sort of intended to be taken literally in when the play was originally written. You know, James I was thought to be descended from Banquo and, you know, the real Scottish figure to some extent. And so, you know, weaving in the contrast between this older man who acts ultimately, you know, sort of in a way that is, he sees as calculating, but is sort of rash to gain a kingship, while at the same time, this younger man is working much more subtly behind the scenes, I thought added, you know, just an interesting depth to the movie, which is not to say that Macbeth itself is not a deep play.
Shallow.
But I thought that was a really interesting set of small alterations that added up to something genuinely novel in a way that I thought was quite striking.
Peter, you described this movie over text to us as art house Braveheart, which I thought was fairly amusing. What were you getting at there?
Oh, look, it's just about, you know, the Scottish kings and stuff, and right, this movie is so self-consciously arty in a way that I truly love and appreciate, but it's like if you compare it to something like Braveheart, which is just such a classic, you know, late 90s populist Oscar bait, like, you know, a crowd pleaser. I think it was actually a summer release, which is sort of rare for that sort of thing, right? But just like feels like they feel very different, right? But they're both in some ways about, you know, who's going to be king of Scotland? And that's all I was really getting at. This is an interesting movie in a bunch of ways. You pointed out the art direction, Sonny, and I think that's just the thing that is really interesting here, just because of the way that it kind of channels German expressionism. As it happens, I watched Tim Burton's Batman Returns just a couple of days before watching this, and it was really kind of notable how much, well, I don't mean to say that this movie drew from Tim Burton's Batman films. At the same time, they both are working from the same sort of inspirations. And it's just really, I mean, it's just an incredibly striking film to look at. And I found myself thinking that this is almost the kind of movie that you could pitch to people who like weird cinema. This is not a populist film, right? It's not like a big crowd pleaser for, you know, that's going to make $200 million at the box office. But you could pitch this to a certain type of person who doesn't particularly care for Shakespeare, but just likes cool sounds and images. Because this movie just sort of, it works almost independent of the language. And I'm not saying the language doesn't add anything, that the story is not important, or anything like that. But the film is just so, like, it's such a wonderful mood to just sort of sink into entirely on its own, apart from the actual Shakespeare aspect of it, which is the script. And so it's just really interesting on that front. But the other thing that struck me here that I just wanted to raise for you guys is I was actually just taken by the fact that it is 500 years after this play was first performed, a little more, and we're still watching, like, people, it is still a non-scholars, non-erudite, like, weird, people who are not, like, Shakespeare studies professors still watch Shakespeare. And I kind of was thinking that Shakespeare is, in a weird sense, the most successful IP in pop culture history, right? Like, this is, Shakespeare is the franchise that just won't, that won't go away. And won't, people, because people keep, right, rebooting and recycling and remaking this stuff in a way that is, like, you can't think of another example. It's not that other art doesn't survive for hundreds of years or even thousands.
There's the Bible.
Right?
There's, but that's, there's a, various,
the
various books,
Odyssey,
of the Bible.
But the Bible, the,
yeah,
Bible is
Homer. And
okay,
Virgil.
Right. Again, it's not that art, that other art doesn't survive, but it basically is.
There's a literal pantheon of gods.
Maybe you could argue that this is that the Greek gods are competing here, but I just think it's like like this is
I think
take
that your
Shakespeare.
Point.
Shakespeare is a weird kind of franchise historically. That, like, that Hollywood now just treats as, like, well, we can actually make the original, like they did here, or we can use this as source material for West Side Story, for, you know, 10 Things I Hate About You, for, right,
but,
like,
but
we can just adapt all of this stuff.
And, yeah, but that's been, yes, I mean, yes, but that's been Shakespeare for like, the last 200 years, right? Is it, like, very,
yes,
it's
that's
not,
kind
it's
of my point.
So much,
and
so,
so I'm really excited for, like, the, to, you know, for the, my uploaded, the uploaded everlasting version of myself to watch a Spider-Man adaptation 500 years from now.
Spider-Man, okay. Spider-Hamlet.
But I mean, I think that, you know, the omnipresence of Shakespeare is sort of self-perpetuating, right? Because the language, and the plots are so well known that it's a kind of irresistible temptation if you're a director or an actor to try and take them on and find something new in them. And, you know, to see the total calmness with which Washington delivers the, you know, tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in its petty pace from day to day speech after Lady Macbeth has committed suicide is, you know, sort of novel to watch, that sort of deep quiet. Or, you know, the fight scene that precedes that moment where he takes on young Seaward, who is armed with a sword and does so with this kind of crazed courage because he believes that the witch's prophecy that he can't be killed by a man born of woman essentially makes him invincible, right? I mean, that's a scene where he's, you know, he's taking his bare hands up against a guy with a sword and, you know, winning with, again, this sort of
full equalizer,
amazing Elan. You know, and at the same time, I thought Corey Hawkins, who plays Macduff and who was excellent in The Heights as well. We talked a little bit earlier this year about just how wonderful and charismatic he is. You know, he is really interesting in that role, in part because of, you know, the vulnerability he lets his character feel. I mean, the moment when he finds out that his wife and son are dead and he is sort of urged to, you know, put his grief aside so he can take effective vengeance on Macbeth. And he says, you know, I shall do, but first I must also, feel it like a man. You know, he transforms this idea that grief is weakness into the idea that feeling it is, and letting it pass over him and through him is manly in a way that, you know, the other characters around him can't appreciate. You know, it's just, it's incredibly fun to see an actor as important in the American pantheon as Washington take his crack at Macbeth, but also to see a young rising actor like Hawkins, you know, step into this lesser role and be incredibly distinctive in it.
What did you make of Frances McDormand in this? We haven't really talked about Lady Macbeth at all. Lady Macbeth is, you know, kind of one of the most famous female characters in any art form still extant, and I feel like I feel like I'm alone in this, but it did nothing for me. It, like, I thought she was, like, honestly, I thought the Lady Macbeth sections of the movie were among the weaker in the film.
I think she's better in the early going, but she's definitely playing Lady Macbeth as sort of more mannered than Washington is playing Macbeth. He plays Macbeth, you know, with a very naturalistic approach to the language. And she often is just a little, you know, it seems like she is performing Shakespeare, whereas Washington is being Macbeth. And I thought in particular, you know, the kind of fussiness and showiness of her performance in the, you know, out, damned spot sequence, is a real weakness of that scene. The one moment in that scene that really works is when she, you know, turns to the servants who are spying on her and tells them to go to bed, and they're not quite sure if she's awake or still sleepwalking. But yeah, no, I actually don't think you're alone in this at all, Sunny. I think certainly not from my perspective and not from other critics I've seen.
Okay, good. Good. I'm not. I love Denzel's line readings in this movie because, as you say, it's like it's not he is not doing kind of standard Shakespeare. It is. There's a real Training Day vibe, especially to the last hour or so of the film as he gets like a little nuttier and crazier and like more you know, violent. That really worked for me. I don't know.
What did you guys think of the present day political connotations that are, I think, pretty clearly there and yet don't feel forced? Well,
I will be honest, I did not feel anything about modern politics watching this.
You didn't think that it was an interesting choice to make a play about a mad king, about somebody whose like desire for power leads them to madness and like murder and bad decisions right now? Like
the more strike you as a choice, the ballsier thing, some relevance. The ballsier thing would have been to do Trump as King Lear with you know, like gender flipping some of the daughters into, you know, Trump's rotten sons and trying to make us feel sympathetic to him. No, I thought part of what was fun about watching this was the sort of the way that the production design, the costuming, et cetera, kind of takes you out of time deliberately, where, you know, the costumes are, you know, sort of intended to be historically accurate, but the architecture is meant to be, you know, sort of so austere and blank that it takes you out of any specific place or time. I mean, I thought it was more sort of transporting for that rather than for trying to be a kind of fleeting allegory.
Yeah, I thought it did not jump out at me as particularly timely. It definitely felt timeless in the way that Shakespeare frequently does.
I don't mean that I thought it was pushy. I in fact thought the opposite, but it did seem to me an interesting choice to make this particular movie now, and perhaps one that was not totally unrelated to world events, but possibly okay. I'm just
all right. Hey, man. We all bring our own baggage into it. You know, it's all right. It's okay.
It's not my baggage, Sonny.
It's the world's baggage.
Everybody's.
All right. So, what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on the tragedy of Macbeth? Peter.
Thumbs up.
Alyssa.
Thumbs up.
Thumbs up. Three thumbs up. Good movie. Based on a pretty good play. Okay, that's it for this week's show. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode on the Scream sequel / soft reboot. And make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.